Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What can a young educator teach in that critical first year in the classroom? And what might she learn about how her own passionate commitment to help her students love learning jives with the long-established conventions of public school education? My guest today found that out in the 1990s when she undertook her first momentous year as a fifth-grade teacher in a school filled with at-risk inner-city kids. Esme Raji Codell's book has just been released in paperback for its 10th anniversary with some updated ideas at the end for new teachers. The book is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. She currently works as an education advocate and runs the children's literature website Planet Esme. Esme, welcome to Think.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris.
Let's talk about the school that you first taught at. It was a brand new campus being staffed, I guess, from the ground up. Can you tell us a little bit about the place?
Yes. It was on the north side of Chicago, in Chicago's inner city. The population was mostly children of color, African-American and Spanish-speaking populations, very low income. And we were lucky enough to have a brand new building with a whole brand new staff of lots and lots of first-year teachers.
It was a brand new building, but in fact, you started the school year with bullet holes in your window.
That's right. Well, things get worn out quickly in Chicago, Chris. But I did have bullet holes in my classroom window. They were supposed to be fixed. It took a little while for them to get fixed. I also learned very quickly that even in a new building, public school teachers tend to subsidize their own classrooms a lot. So teachers brought in their own books and a lot of times their own chalk.
You brought in your own books, and in fact, you were really discouraged by the quality of the textbooks that your students had, especially for reading, and said, we're just not going to use these.
Well, you know, Chris, I really went back to what I knew to be my own reading truth, which is I love to laugh when I read. I love the feeling of being less alone. And as much as I like textbooks, I've never taken one under a blanket with me, a flashlight. I've never said to a friend, oh, you've just got to read this textbook. And I sure as heck have never cried at the end of a textbook. So I really wanted to be able to share a very genuine love of reading, because I think every teacher goes in with something to share. For me, it was a love of literature. For other teachers, it might be a love of architecture, it might be a love of sports. Whatever a teacher has, I think there's a way you can integrate it into your classroom.
So you come in with all of this passion and you really feel well prepared, but from the beginning, your determination about what your students ought to call you even seemed to make your principal crazy. And that turned into sort of a metaphor for his opposition to your approach to everything.
Yeah, sort of. I probably, you know, when I read this book, and it's been a little bit of time since it's been written, I probably wasn't the easiest person to deal with. But when I first came to become a teacher, I had worked hard and trained hard in a traditional program, jumped through a lot of hoops, and on my first day, as a little gift to myself for making it, I gave myself the name Madame Esme, and the children addressed me as Madame Esme, and this wasn't sort of the homogenous way that the administration preferred me to be addressed. And my argument was, well, if the children can't deal with people having all different kinds of names, we can throw in the towel right now. And I think that looking back, that might have seemed like an odd battle to choose. And new teachers starting out know there's a lot of battles to choose from management to materials you're using. But for the population that I was trying to serve, I think it was really important that they know that America is really about inventing yourself, and not just if you're a movie star or an athlete. Even if you're an everyday person like a teacher, you can invent yourself and create an environment that you dream of, and that's what I was trying to do. So even though it caused a little bit of friction, it's a decision I'm glad I made, and children and adults still call me Madame Esme.
One thing I think that's really remarkable in the book is that when you arrive with these fifth graders, some of them were struggling mightily with concepts that they ought to have learned in first or second grade. But you were really careful not to embarrass them when you went back to basics. In fact, at one point you had them work on their letter sounds by saying, okay, we're going to put this all together for the kindergarten kids.
Yeah, we had an alphabet museum in which which they created by bringing in small objects, and we went over all the sounds, quote-unquote, for the kindergartners. It wasn't their fault that they didn't know this material. And as an educator, you can really get caught up in how upset you are that they don't know something and they don't have the requisite skills. But the real task of teaching is meeting children wherever they are. And you know, not every kid has access to books at home. Not every child has exposure to print every day. It's not easy to learn to read. And so rather than see it as a problem, it's a wonderful opportunity for a teacher to make that change in the life of an older child.
Well, the interesting balance that you were able to strike here is the fact that you recognized where they had come from and what they were struggling with, but you also set pretty high expectations for them.
Oh, yeah, really high. The highest. Wherever they were starting, I was happy to help them, but I expected them to still climb those stairs. I think part of it was I had had a similar upbringing. I myself grew up in Chicago, in the inner city, in a very diverse neighborhood, and a pretty, my mother didn't like the word poor, but we were very broke, I guess was the term she liked. So we were broke. The difference was I did have parents who loved literature and loved print and made sure I was fed a regular diet of it. So I knew that could make all the difference in the world. That was the difference between myself and a lot of my friends who went on to work at a local pinata factory. So I really wanted to give that to the children I was serving, and also it just wasn't that intimidating. I had come through the Chicago public school system myself, and even though I didn't go to fancy schools, I was really lucky enough to have fancy teachers, and it was my turn to pay it forward.
You had a wonderful mentor as well who helped you understand very important things, including the reality that no single thing that you said in any particular day could make or break a child.
Yeah, theoretically. Yeah, oh, my mentor was amazing. She was, well, I guess to some people she might have been perceived as an evil old cantankerous woman. She wasn't opposed to raising her voice, and I recall a little bit of ear pulling, old school, but I wasn't really going to imitate her. But what I really learned from her is how important it is to be invested in your approach. Whatever it is, you have to go into teaching with a faith that the way you're doing it is going to make a difference. I wasn't going to do it her way, but just seeing that really made a difference in how committed I was to my own approaches. And actually, in the new guide that's in the reissued Educating Esme, which has 25 hints for new teachers, that's one of the most important pieces of advice I give, is to find a mentor. Find somebody out there who can show you where the long reach stapler is in the building, or maybe just get you through a rough day. It's a very isolating job. I mean, even though you're surrounded by children all day, there's no other adult who says, wow, you did great, or man, you really messed up, or you could do this better next time. And so a mentor is really important. Sometimes there's not a mentor in the building to turn to, but really luckily now there's places like teachers.net where you can find online mentorship.
Well, it's really striking, Esme, when you drive home how exhausting it is to be a teacher. You write that essentially you experience not one day at a time, but 31 days,
yeah.
One for each unique student in your class.
That's true. It's a very long day. I think people think that the teacher's day is done when the child's day is done, but it's a far cry from that. But I think, actually, I had this wonderful opportunity to travel around the country when this book was published and speak to both teachers and parents. And a lot of their complaints were the same. I mean, I heard from so many parents who said, when I come home at the end of the day, I'm so exhausted. It's really hard for me to help my child with his or her homework. Or how am I expected to compete with all the other media, television and computers, and how do I prioritize that in my home or in my classroom? I think there are so many connections to be made between home and school, And these days, it makes all the difference in the world to the child when those connections are made. I really, if I can just say, there's a really easy answer to that, Chris. For me, I found it in my classroom through children's literature. I think people think of children's books as, you know, cute little books with bunnies and puppies. But in fact, children's books, I really believe, are our best hope for equalizing education in America, because a great book in the hands of a rich child is that same great book in the hands of a poor child who can read. So I really have spent a lot of my career advocating for equal education through increased use of children's literature.
And you believe really resolutely that it's important to keep reading even to kids who are in 6th, 7th, 8th grade.
Oh, absolutely. But it's not just me who believes it. There's 10,000 pieces of research out there from the U.S. Department of Education. They were all gathered and compiled in something called A Nation of Readers. It was a report. And it all came to the same conclusion, which is if you want to ensure academic success for children, the best thing you can possibly do is read aloud across the grade levels. Now, this is really interesting because if that's an educational fact in a world of theory, it's really interesting to me that most teachers in teacher training receive one class of children's literature, which to me is the equivalent of sending out a plumber into his field without a wrench. You can't individualize instruction without a knowledge of the tools.
Yeah, and so it's important not only to sort of grab one book, but to know what's out there, and so that you can find a student who's interested in something and sort of tie them up with a book that will mean something to them.
Sure, and you know, another mistake I think we often make is we think of real readers as readers of fiction, like someone who reads Harry Potter or Alice in Wonderland. But in fact, readers of nonfiction are real readers too, and we end up excluding a lot of boys from the mix when we don't acknowledge how-to books and Sports Illustrated magazines as real reading, because most people, that's the kind of stuff they read, and they're real readers too.
What did it take for you? I know that you worked in a bookstore for years before you became a teacher.
Oh, yeah. I worked as a children's bookseller for 7 years, I believe, before I started my teaching career. And I really loved children's bookselling, but I needed health insurance. So I tried to think of the job that was most like children's bookselling, and education seemed to be the way to go.
Can you talk now about why you think you felt you were so ready just as you were starting out, a moment at which a lot of young teachers, you know, will later sort of confess to abject terror on that first day?
Well, I think, to be perfectly honest, I was really well trained. Mm-hmm. I had this amazing mentor. I had also had some less amazing mentors before her, who I still managed to learn some things from. And I had been through a traditional program where I was taught how to teach every single subject and given the time to create materials for each subject. I have to tell you, when I'm in the field now, I see a lot of teachers, especially teachers in urban settings, that have gone through really quick fix programs where they're trained for 6 weeks and then sort of thrown to the wolves, so to speak. Mm. It's a bit of a trial by fire, and it's really natural. I thought the same thing when I was in training. You want to get to work so badly. You love the children, and you want to help. But if you really love children, you have to be prepared to put your best foot forward, and that takes training. It's not easy to handle a group of 35 kids with
Esme Rajiko, let me just pause here. We need to take a break. Esme Rajiko-Dell is my guest. Her book is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. You can join us now by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former teacher and current education and literacy advocate Esme Raji-Codel. Her book is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send an email to think@kera.org or you can call us at 1-800-933-5372. We should go back to this for a minute. Your kids, as a group, that first year, seem to have had collectively every possible disadvantage you could want to have. How did you think about that when you were deciding whether to involve parents in the struggles that a particular child was having and when it might actually be detrimental to that child to call in mom or dad?
Well, that's a really good question. I have to admit, during my first year of teaching, I really enjoyed the lack of parent participation because it can go either way. I mean, sometimes parents can really ride a teacher, so it's very difficult to focus on your goals, and there can be very individual agendas that come into play.
Sure.
So I really didn't mind that some of my kids, most of their contact was through beepers at the time. Right before cell phones, and it was very, very hard to get in touch with parents sometimes. That could be a little bit dangerous. Sometimes they were homeless, and I didn't know it, and they would lie about their address. But I do think, with a little more experience under my belt, that it's definitely beneficial if there's a little bit more cooperation between what's going on at school and what's going on at home. But I think part of the reality of teaching, not just in the city, but everywhere, because people have parents who are working really hard, it's not to assume that there's going to be a parent at home who's literate, not to assume there's going to be a parent at home at all, gives assignments that reflect what a child can do on his or her own, which, again, it's something you sort of learn with experience.
Yeah, there was one amazing day where one of your students brought a 2-year-old sibling to class because there was no one home to take care of the baby.
Yes, and there was also no one home who could be reached. Mm. So I taught that day with the baby on my hip, and that was okay, except I was very conflicted about whether or not to call home, or actually to let my administration know. Because sometimes that sets a ball rolling where children get removed from their families. And this is what you have to do. It's what you're supposed to do. But when you know these children, it sometimes chokes you up to have to do it.
Yeah. And there were also cases where parents would come in and you would have a conference about some misbehavior, and the parents would sort of instantly start wailing on the kid right in your presence.
Yeah, that's actually happened a few times in my teaching career. I think it really speaks to the stress of parenting.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a sadness when children don't achieve the way we dream that they will. But it's also an indicator of how important it is for children to be removed, if not physically, from those kind of situations, sort of emotionally, where they don't have to always be thinking about this kind of drama, because according to educational theory, Maslow's hierarchy, if they don't feel secure, they can't concentrate at all. You won't be able to teach them a thing. So during my first year of teaching, I implemented the trouble basket, which was a big green basket, and every morning when I greeted the children, I would hold it out and offer the opportunity to pantomime unloading whatever what was going on at home into the basket. And I would offer that they could pick it up at the end of the day, though I never had any takers. Now, it was just sort of a play act, just a sort of signifier that we're leaving our troubles at the door, so to speak, and it wasn't always possible to do that. But it reminded children that school is a different place than home is, and we don't bring all of our troubles, me included as a teacher. When we're in that classroom, we have work to do, and we have a different focus than our shortcomings. We have to focus on where we're going.
Yeah, and you were conscious of the fact that sometimes school was that oasis of safety in a life that was otherwise really scary.
Oh, well, I really believed that for myself as a child growing up in Chicago. I treasured school as that. So I really wanted to do that for the children I served.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Reza in Plano. Hi, Reza.
Hi, how are you?
Great, thank you.
I have a question. I have two children, one's kindergarten, one's second grade. My daughter is second grade, is a little bit behind reading. She has trouble pronouncing full words, and we took her to the library yesterday, try to get her things like to do sight words. She has trouble doing it. She's second grade. I'm a physician, and I had a patient come in with her granddaughter, first, second grade, reading on a fourth grade level. I just need to know some advice on what can I do to up her reading or anything, just say it was software, website, et cetera.
Thanks for your call. What do you think, Esme?
Well, there's a couple things you can do. It's actually not that uncommon, though you might think it is from the way people talk, but a lot of kids learn to read around the second grade. And one thing you can do is activate the closed captioning feature on all of your television channels so that whenever a child is watching television, they get exposure to print. This is a something that's used in Scandinavia, which is a part of the world where they don't even really address reading until kids are about 8 years old, and just that exposure to print really helps. Another thing I'd recommend is there's a series called All Aboard Reading that has a lot of sight word vocabulary mixed with visual cues, pictures, sort of rebuses. And this allows children to feel very confident and successful. So I'd recommend that if your child doesn't have any particular learning differences and just needs a little boost.
We have an email here from Bill in Dallas who writes, my son is in eighth grade in a very advantaged local school district, and his language arts class requires exactly 1 hour of reading per week, about 10 minutes a day. And this is so disappointing. He writes, my wife, who is Russian, had to read War and Peace in seventh grade and was quizzed even on the battle details. Is there any likelihood that a culture whose main interest is in raising children to get high-paying jobs as opposed to becoming educated and independent thinkers can properly value the benefit of substantial reading again?
Wow, that's a great question. It's a tricky question. I think yes. I think what this question really speaks to has a little bit to do with the culture of no child left behind. And you know what? I think this phone is about to die on me. So I'm going to answer that question on another line. Is that all right?
Sure, absolutely.
Okay, I'll be back with you in a sec.
My guest is Esme Raji-Codel. She is a former teacher, currently an education and literacy advocate. Her book is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. It was initially published in 1999 when she was just a couple of years into her teaching career. She worked for 2 years as a fifth grade teacher at an underperforming school, or rather at a school for at-risk kids, largely at-risk kids, in urban Chicago. She later worked as a librarian in another school and now runs a website called planetesme.com. That is a children's literature website. Again, her name is Esme Raji-Codel. The book has just been re-released in paperback for the 10th anniversary edition. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372. We're also able to take your emails at think@kera.org. We will bring Esme back in just a moment. She had a phone line issue. We will take a very quick break and be back with you in just a moment. Welcome back to Think. My name is Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Esme Raji-Codel about the 10th anniversary issue of her book, Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. Before the break, Esme, we had that call, the question rather, via email from Bill, who wanted to know about making sure that the kids sort of get back to really valuing education for its own sake, as opposed to simply being trained for a job that will pay them a lot of money.
Well, I think really what we're training kids to do is to be professional test takers. There's so much focus on performance on standardized tests, and even though that question doesn't directly address that issue, that's really one of the outcomes that's being described. When teachers aren't given the space to bring what they have, their passions, the books that they love, to the classroom and have to focus on this sort of homogenized version of education in which every child learns the same thing at the same time and has the same goals, a lot of other values fall to the wayside. And one of them is a love of reading, and one of them is reading not to a particular grade level, but reading a book because it's just plain great, and moving forward in terms of your own literacy in that way. So I think it's one of the insidious side effects of our standardized testing culture that those kind of wonderful opportunities to share great books and sometimes just fun books really falls to the wayside. And our culture will suffer because of it. This isn't something that's not going to have an effect on the way our country runs and the kind of jobs that people are maybe not able to get, but able to succeed at and enjoy. Reading's not just a skill, it's a lifestyle. And it's a real shame when schools of all places don't embrace that. An hour a day, an hour a week is ridiculous.
Yeah. One of the things that you did, mostly out of your own pocket, was often to ensure that while you were reading a book aloud, your students followed along with their own copy in their labs. Can you talk about the value of that and then how difficult that is to do when you're making a starting teacher salary?
Well, it's as far as difficulty with a starting teacher salary, I mean, that's sort of par for the course. You're going to have to get used to that.
Yeah.
What I did, as you described, is I'd have kids follow along. I would have a copy of the book. They'd have the exact same copies of the book. I'd buy multiple copies of the book. But we wouldn't do round robin. We wouldn't have turns for that. There were other times in the day when they might have chance to read from material. But during read-aloud time, I turned down the lights except for a lovely little Victorian desk lamp. They would all get out of their seats, gather around, relax. Some of them brought pillows. No pillow fighting is good. And they'd follow along. The value of that is they weren't stressed about decoding because they weren't thinking, oh, is it my turn next? Is it my turn next? Instead, they could see how punctuation sounds. I mean, they were following along. When a comma happens, it does make a certain sound in terms of the reading. They were able to enjoy the humor because sometimes when they're decoding, they miss a lot of jokes. I was able to introduce books with a lot of dialect. And those kind of things are really hard to read when you're 8, 9, 10, 11 years old. So they were able to enjoy all the nuances of literature and see it. And they also just had huge amounts of exposure to print by the end of the year. They were able to recognize words. They've seen them. If they had to read books all alone, they would have never gotten through the kind of books that we got through. Kids can listen at a much higher level than they can usually read themselves. So this was bringing them up. And by the end of the school year, they had very excellent standardized test scores, by and large. And I never worried about it. I had faith in their critical thinking. And like my mentor taught me, I had a lot of faith in this approach of read aloud. It has everything going for it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to McKinney and speak with Andrea. Hi, Andrea.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a quick question for your guest, Esme. What is your thoughts on the Teach for America movement? They're celebrating their 20-year anniversary in 2010, because it sounds like your experience is very similar to what they experienced in their first years. And I'll take my answer offline. Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Well, that's kind of a tricky wicket for me, because I really believe in the value of teacher training. And I know that Teach for America does offer a teacher training program, but I think it's a bit of a trial by fire. And I feel like there's a terrific need for programs like Teach for America because of the shortages in teaching, and I appreciate that need. But I also feel like if teachers were not qualified to teach in white, affluent schools, why are they qualified to teach populations of poor children of color? I can't resolve that in terms of my own conscience. And so while I see the value in the program, and in fact, it turns out, as far as I know, it turns out teachers into the core that stay about as long as traditionally trained teachers do. I mean, most teachers, or half of teachers, leave after their fifth year of teaching. That's a big problem, whether you're trained for Teach for America or a traditional program. And I think that's really what needs to be addressed, not just recruiting teachers, which is really what Teach for America is about, but creating programs that keep teachers in the profession.
Esme Raji-Codell is my guest. She's a former teacher and currently an education and literacy advocate. Her book in the 10th anniversary issue is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org, or you can get us on the phone at 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, offering a progressive and customized graduate degree with flexible part-time study in Dallas and Plano. You can pursue your passion, and you can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Esme Raji-Codell. We're talking about the 10th anniversary edition of her book, Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. You can join us by sending email to think@kera.org. Esme, you alluded earlier to the stress that can come sometimes from the individual agendas of particular parents. How can a parent who has concerns about what's going on in the classroom with his or her child come across as an ally rather than an adversary of their child's teacher?
Well, I think one of the first things to do is to address the teacher directly. One of the biggest mistakes I think parents make, and I'm a parent too, is going immediately over the head of the teacher instead of trying to create a communication with the person who is seeing your child every single day. I think there can be a tendency on both sides, teacher and parent, to expect the worst or to assume that maybe the child is being picked on or that what you're saying won't be well received. Actually, one of the hints in the new issue of Educating Esme has to do with teachers, a step teachers can do to help make it so the communication is better, is making a phone call the first week of school. A lot of times, teachers send a letter home, which is very nice, but I think when you call home, it sends a very different message. First of all, the child usually finds out that you called, so they know that you have their number.
And you're not afraid to use
way.
It.
Exactly. But another thing is, it really struck me when I've done this, immediately the parents are like, what's the matter? What did he do? What is she missing? And it's really nice to establish that rapport right off the bat with something positive. Just, I'm so happy to see your child. I'm so excited or hopeful, or what a cool picture they drew. Or just starting with something positive and having that verbal communication makes it much easier down the line. And if your teacher doesn't do that and you're a parent, you can just call to say hi before there's a problem, too.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Zach in Fort Worth. Hey, Zach.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for having me on your show.
Sure.
I guess first I wanted to express appreciation for your guest's passion for helping kids learn. But my question is, I wanted to know what were some of her reasons for no longer being in the classroom. I'm a teacher myself in an urban school, and what I've noticed is that teachers will get in the classroom really fired up, and then they'll leave the classroom to go and do other sorts of endeavors and leave the classroom, and so that great teacher no longer is in the classroom.
Well, for me, I can answer very personally to why I left the classroom. I became a school librarian, which in my mind was another kind of teacher, because I really wanted to dedicate myself to the best practice of read aloud every day. and I felt like I could reach a larger number of children in the school population by being a school librarian. And it was also a place where I didn't feel like less of a teacher. I felt like I could do my best teaching. A lot of the things I did and describe in Educating Esme, I was still able to do as a school librarian. But the difference was I didn't have that pressure cooker of standardized teaching that I really predicted would burn me out eventually. And I didn't want to be in schools for that 5-year period. I want to teach for my entire life. So it was a personal decision I made in order to stay in schools and do the best work I know how. The reason I think many teachers leave is, well, Zach, you sound like a guy, but for many women a long time in history, the jobs that were available to us were nurse and secretary and teacher, which are all great professions. But nowadays, women can be anything. And it can be really hard in some school settings when you're treated like another child by administration, when you're weighed down by mandates, and you entered the profession because you wanted to lead and not to follow. Why would someone who's really good at public speaking or selling a lesson, they can be good in business, they can be good in a lot of high-paying endeavors, and they may have families to support. So I think we really need to think hard about how we can value the individuality of teachers in order to keep them.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Alice in Dallas. Hi, Alice.
Hi. I wanted to thank Esme for her contributions through getting her book written. Lots of us have thought about writing books as teachers but didn't. And I'd like to say that I retired after years of applying the same sorts of things she did in my classroom in an inner-city Dallas school, and it works. I had 80% or more pass the state test every year from what they learned from reading literature. You don't have to teach to the test. If you do what's good in teaching, they pass the test.
Alice, what kept you in the classroom for all those years?
The fact that I was desperately needed, mm-hmm. and I had gotten divorced, and I had taught previously. And I did apply for other jobs because I couldn't get a teaching job right away. And that was very discouraging because I was in my early 40s. So when I returned to the classroom, it was like a mission field. And they desperately need intelligent, articulate, thoughtful, creative people to go into teaching. And until the public starts demanding that administration provide the kind of environment in the school where children are expected to behave and respect teachers and they can't call you words that are not sayable on the radio, it's going to be very difficult to keep teachers in inner city settings because you are easily discouraged. Esme's right. You're so isolated, particularly if you're really gung-ho and going after it and spending hours on lesson plans and reading. You don't have to take children's literature. Children's literature is easy to read because it's written for children and you're an adult and you read fast. You can read 2 or 3 children's books a week, you know, young adult literature. You just need to be an expert and consider yourself their hope for the future because if they don't get an education, they surely don't have a rich uncle that's going to leave them a fortune, do they?
Alice, thanks so much for your call. Esme, it sounds like she definitely sort of relates to your story. Do you, when you look back on your own, when you read this book from 1999, do you fully relate to the person who was writing it?
Well, first of all, I think I'm in love. I just wish this was the Alice show because she hit it so much on the head. And if you're asking about how much I relate to the younger woman who wrote this diary, I think I was pretty strident. And that's an adjective I'm using for a less polite adjective that I could use. I was pretty mouthy for a first-year teacher. I was pretty confident, probably cocky. But in other professions, like if you're a lawyer, you don't get to say, oh, I'm sorry you went to jail, but I'm a first-year lawyer. And you don't, if you're a doctor, you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I put your leg on backwards, I'm a first-year doctor. And we need to go into that profession with the kind of pride and ability, not the rush jobs, but the dedication to deliver the best service that these children deserve. But, you know, all that's really easy to say. It's harder to do. It is a dedication not only to practice but to content, which I think Alice really addressed. You have to know the materials that you want to share before you can share them. And to that end, I've actually created a couple of websites. One of them is planetesme.blogspot.com, where I review the best brand spanking new children's literature as well as some oldies but goodies, because about 12,000 children's books are published every year, and even a very well-meaning teacher or parent would have a hard time navigating through that. But all the books on this website are field-tested, kid and teacher approved. And I also have a new blog, educatingesme.blogspot.com, which I hope will build community and support for first-year teachers and help them feel less alone during that adventure of a first year.
Sometimes parents will lament the fact that their kids do read, but they only read one sort of book. They finish the Harry Potter series, and then they want only books about wizards and other settings. Is that something to worry about, or is that fine because they've got their nose in a book?
I don't think it's anything really to worry about as long as they're still reading. I think people also worry a lot about series books like Junie B. Jones, or it used to be Ramona Quimby, or The Magic Treehouse is another popular one. But it's sort of like revisiting Friends. You get to be familiar with the same characters over and over, or the same style, and eventually it's natural to want to branch out a little bit. The only difference I see is fantasy readers and mystery readers tend to stay fantasy and mystery readers, and they might dabble a little, but if you got one of those on your hands, just keep giving them what they like.
Let's go next on the phone to Arlington, where we'll speak with Tony. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead, please.
Yes, I was just going to congratulate the guest that you have on your show. She's doing a wonderful job, even though she's not currently in the I'd say face-to-face teaching profession. I think that more people should actually do what she's done that have retired from that. But one thing I wanted to call about was, you know, there are resources available that most people don't realize. And I, for years and years, let me tell you, that me and my wife had totally rejected Jehovah's Witnesses when they would come to our door. We just slammed the door in our face. But one time about a year and a half ago, this young lady, about 22 years old, came, and my wife accepted that she give our child, our four-year-old child, a Bible study using a book that they publish. And you would not believe the progress in reading that this child has gone through in the past year and a half, almost 2 years. And the kicker about it is they do it for free. They don't charge anything. So for all those years that I treated them so wrong, I cannot believe how ashamed I am now of the treatment that I gave those people when I see the help that they've been with my child.
Yeah, Tony,
his reading ability.
Thanks so much for your call. And that is an interesting point. There may be places outside the sort of standard classroom setting where families can find help.
Yeah, like the public library will do a lot of that same kind of work where you go in and you can get a book for free. It works pretty well. And can I just say one more thing, because I want to be sure to say this before we're out of time.
Sure.
I did travel all over the country. I had this wonderful blessing in my life to meet all these teachers from all sorts of corners. But I have to say, Texas teachers were a complete standout. Texas teachers, I think in Texas there's a special amount of pressure as far as standardized testing goes. It's a birthplace and a starting ground for a lot of those kind of tests. And I found Texas teachers to be so utterly creative in terms of still being able to bring themselves and a love and passion for learning, even amidst all these mandates at sort of a ground zero. And I think it was Alice who said that she could have written a book about her teaching experiences, and I hear that so often. I could have written that book, but I just want to say to teachers who may not be listening because they're probably starting their afternoons right now, but I think there's a lot of room on this shelf. There's a lot of room for our anecdotes and stories and what we know happens to work, and I hope that we can start contributing that, and don't be shy about it. Don't think, oh, this is a story like any other story. This is how we're going to improve. And my diary was published to create a conversation about urban education and public education and teachers, and every other voice is part of that conversation and just as important.
So, Esme, you've experienced the public schools as a student and as a teacher. Now, as a parent with a child in school, has that added anything to what you understand about how things get done?
I think it just furthered my appreciation for the difference a good teacher can make and how important it is to support teachers who bring something original to the classroom and aren't just teaching to the test, because they're fighting a battle, too. And as a parent, I can play a different advocacy role for that teacher as well.
In the last few seconds we have left, what advice would you offer teachers about making sure they find the right position for themselves to use their skills?
The right position for themselves?
Yeah, the right school or the right environment to be teaching in.
Interview the principal. Look at the school's website. Don't be afraid of asking questions. Good schools deserve good teachers, and they'll understand when you aren't shy and you ask.
Former teacher Esme Raji-Codel currently works as an education advocate and runs the children's literature website Planet Esme. Her book, released in paperback for its 10th anniversary, is called Educating Esme, Diary of a Teacher's First Year. Esme, it's been a great hour. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you and all your listeners. Happy September.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.
Last September, the economic meltdown rallied the financial community around government solutions. Now the crisis has eased, but so has consensus.
I don't think you need an agency for the banks. I mean, you may need an agency for everybody else, but we're saying is we do not need an agency for the banks.
Moving forward from the financial crisis, but in what direction? That's today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This afternoon at 4 on KERA 90.1.
It's 12:59. You're listening to your source for NPR News, KERA 90.1, Dallas-Fort Worth, Denton. In Tyler, it's K261 CW 100.1. We're at K202 DR 88.3 in Wichita Falls, and K257 EV 99.3 in Sherman. It's 1 o'clock.
I'm Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, Allied Heroes, Nazi Thieves, and the Greatest Treasure Hunt in History. We'll speak with Dallasite Robert Edsel, whose latest book details the achievements of the group known as the Monuments Men, who went overseas with a mission to preserve Europe's most important edifices and soon found themselves in a race to recover centuries' worth of its greatest art. We'll find out how they saved some of the most important works of the Western world despite having few resources and essentially no authority, and learn about the works of art that might not exist today without the Monuments Men. Our conversation begins after the news from National Public Radio.